The second reading of today is from the book of Daniel. Daniel 1 on page 819 of the Old Testament section of your Pew Bibles. Daniel 1 verses 1 to 10. In the third year of the reign of King Jehoiakim of Judah, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord let King Jehoiakim of Judah fall into his power, as well as some of the vessels of the house of God. These he brought to the land of Shinar, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his gods. Then the king commanded his palace master Ashpenaz to bring some of the Israelites of the royal family and of the nobility, young men without physical defect and handsome, versed in every branch of wisdom, endowed with knowledge and insight, and competent to serve in the king's palace. They were to be taught the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the royal rations of food and wine. They were to be educated for 3 years, so that at the end of that time they could be stationed in the king's court. Among them were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah from the tribe of Judah. The palace master gave them other names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the royal rations of food and wine. So he asked the palace master to allow him not to defile himself. Now God allowed Daniel to receive favor and compassion from the palace master. The palace master said to Daniel, "I am afraid of my lord the king. He has appointed your food and your drink. If he should see you in poorer condition than the other young men of your own age, you would endanger my head with the king." This is the word of the Lord.
Special appearances are on the radio, but Ravi, it is a distinct pleasure to introduce you to Union Church and to invite you to our pulpit. May God bless your ministry with us.
Thank you very much, Pastor Greg. It was many years ago, actually, that I was here. I was careful to say that many years ago because my wife says the older Ravi gets, everything becomes recently. No matter what I say, it was recently, whether it was 1 week ago or 10 years ago. It seems like so much goes on in shorter spans of time that it all gets bundled together and you're not quite sure. I don't know when I was here. It was several years ago. I do know that. Maybe you might need to go into the gravestones or the archives or something. Probably 8 or 9 years ago when I held a week of meetings here and enjoyed it very much. And I think I came back once after that for a Keswick conference, and now to return to Hong Kong after all these years, it's been a real honor. In the earliest days of my ministry, when I was starting out in the 70s, still doing my undergraduate studies in Toronto, I happened to go through here and was going to speak in Vietnam. So it was one of the first places I ever preached, I think. And maybe that's why I'm not coming back as often. I have nothing left to say. I remember speaking several times for the well-known pastor Philip Tang at the North Point Alliance Church here, and then his son Bill Tang actually became a student of mine when I was teaching in New York. So there's a lot of memories and connections here, and I just want you to know what an honor it is to come even on a rainy day like this. And hopefully my flight will take off this afternoon. I have to fly and head back in the homeward direction. As I pondered what I could say to you in a few short minutes this morning, I have taken the text that has been read for you moments ago from the book of Daniel. But let me position this for you as to why I am presenting this message to you this morning. We look for greatness, don't we? Especially at times of great turmoil and uncertainty. There's a longing in your heart that somebody will emerge amidst the cloudiness of confusion and be able to shine a light in the path so that you can see a clear exit or a clear way to find some solutions. It happens in your life, whether it's spoken or not. It happens in my life. Sometimes it happens in the throes of a personal conflict. At other times it happens amidst the tensions of an entire nation in search of answers. This morning as I got up and was actually packing my bags, I turned on the television and the lead program was on what brought us to this mess financially. And they were going back to the depression in America in the 1930s. I decided to turn it off and figured if I'd stay long enough, they'd go back to Genesis chapter 3 and find out where the answer really is. Because, as Malcolm Muggeridge said, all new news is old news happening to new people. All new news is old news happening to new people. Muhammad Ali, the famed heavyweight boxing champion who was not known exactly for his humility, was once sitting on a plane that hit moderate turbulence. And the pilot announced and asked everybody to fasten their seat belts. Everybody complied except Ali. So the flight attendant went over to him and said, "Excuse me, sir, would you please comply with the captain's command to fasten your seat belt?" Big-chested Ali looked at her and said, "Superman don't need no seat belt." She looked at him and said, "Superman don't need no airplane either." Every now and then we think we are supermen and superwomen, and all of a sudden we find out we're not. Percy Bysshe Shelley, the famed English poet, put it in these words, referring to the demagogues who'd come and gone. "I met a traveler from an antique land who said two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose eyes and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that the sculptor well those passions read. And on the pedestal these words appear, 'My name is Ozymandias. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair.' And round the boundless sands flow far away." He tells us of the fact that beyond the colossal wreck, the lone and desert stands really stretch far away. "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair." But nothing beside remains round that colossal wreck. The lone and level sands stretch far away. And if you go into the desert terrain today, you'll see these crestfallen statues. You'll see the half-sunken faces of stone that once upon a time clenched their fist and stood strong and mighty. I want to point you instead to a different poet pointing to a different theme. She wrote it in these words: "When God wants to drill a man and thrill a man and skill a man, when God wants to mold a man to play the noblest part, when he yearns with all his heart to create so great and bold a man that all the world might be amazed, watch his methods, watch his ways. How he ruthlessly perfects whom he royally elects, how he hammers and hurts him and with mighty blows converts him into trial shapes of clay that only God understands, while his tortured heart is crying and he lifts beseeching hands. How he bends but never breaks when his good he undertakes, how he uses whom he chooses and with mighty acts induces him to try his splendor out. God knows what he's about." And so you can look across the desert terrain and see fallen statues of self-styled demagogues who thought themselves great but who've come and gone. Or you can look and see how God molds and shapes a man or a woman of faith and what it is he pours into that individual to create a life and shape a life of lasting and eternal influence. And in times like this, that's the kind of man and woman the world is looking for. into whose life God has poured that kind of molding and shaping influence that it is not a fallen statue you look at, but an everlasting legacy of nobility and truth and lasting values. What does a man like that look like? Have you ever asked yourself a question? How do we determine who the real hero is? Who is the one who wanted us to look at his works and despair because of his strength and his power? Or is it the one who quietly but effectively lives a life of such strength that the impact continues unshakably for centuries to come? I want to look at a man like that. His name is Daniel. And I want to take three lessons from Daniel's life and show you why I believe it is a man like this that we really need at a time like this, and what were the qualities in the life of this man. You know, Israel had many, many leaders. They came and went. If you were to look at what caused their downfall, it would boil down to three mistakes they made. Number one was the untamed passions in a gifted man. Number two was wanton power in a weak man. And number three was the unteachable temperament of a privileged man. If you have untamed passions, abused power, and an unteachable temperament, your kingdom personally will rise and fall as well. What you need is lessons of eternal value and eternal strength, and Daniel gives that to us. Here is the way his life was lived out. First is this. He is brought into a palace and all of a sudden given all the luxuries that the palatial residents were entitled to. Now the ironic thing about this is he's an exile. Why is he selected? He's selected because of his intellectual strength and his striking personality. Whenever you see a person who wants to control a nation, you will see in one way or the other, he will take the finest intellects he can find in the land, young men and young women of influence, and shape them into becoming the ambassadors of his or her message. And so this man is a uniquely gifted man. He's got all the intellectual strength to succeed. I suspect, Nebuchadnezzar said, you better get the best of these Israelites and get them onto our side, or we'll have a rebellion on our hand with the best of the intellects on the other side. And whenever you're looking for the intellects, who are you looking for? You're looking for people who understand the times and have influence in their capacity to communicate what it is that the answer really, where the answer really lies. And so they've got these boys, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Daniel, brought into the palace, and they're being wined and dined and softened up. How many of us would have been able to resist that? You know, the selfish attitude would have been, what does it really matter? I'm okay. I've got the palace as my residence. I'm getting the best of meals. You know, I remember when I first started to preach, getting all kinds of invitations that I wished I had never got. You know, they invite you into Red Deer, Alberta, in Midwestern Canada, in the middle of February, which is almost purgatorial in its testing strength. The winter is vicious. And I'd say to myself, now, I don't mind coming here, but why in February? Couldn't you have done it in May or June or something? Why not Hawaii at a time like this? And all of a sudden you feel God leading you into more comfortable places because you don't like the hard, rugged climate. And yet sometimes the greatest disciplines are built when you're in those rough terrains and your calling is tested, and you then have to evaluate in your own heart why you are in this. So Daniel's given this feast. And he looks at the steward and he says, look, I'm all right. I don't want all of this. Will you please give me just an ordinary diet? And the steward says, I can't do that. The king wants to toughen up you boys. in some ways and make you look healthy and stronger than the rest of them. I cannot deny the king's command. I cannot listen to your wish. He says, I'll make a deal with you. You give me the diet I'm asking you to give me. And at the end of a certain amount of time, you check me out against the rest of these boys. And if I'm not looking as well and healthy as the rest of them, then you can have your way. Until then, let me have it my way. Why did Daniel do this? Why did Daniel actually do this? Here's the point. He drew his line of resistance by training his appetite. He drew his line of resistance by training his appetite. Do you know you train your hungers? You train what it is you actually want? And sometimes when you cross the line in a dangerous way to create new appetites, you had no idea how deep this was going to ultimately take you. I remember one night, 11:30 or midnight, in my home in Atlanta, my telephone rang, and it was somebody I knew very well. He was a very successful medical doctor. And I knew there had to be something urgent for him to be calling at that hour of the night. He said, Rav, I'm sorry to wake you up. He said, I'm in trouble. I said, what's the matter? He said, I'm in serious trouble. He said, as you know, I work in the emergency room doing emergency surgeries at night. He said, tonight a woman was brought in here in a very pathetic shape. She was so badly beaten up by the man she was with, every major bone in her body was broken, almost shattered. He said, when the ambulance brought her in, my team around me said, Doc, she's gone. Let her go. He said, when I looked at that battered and bruised body, I said, there's no way we can let her go. We've got to do everything we possibly can. He said, I quickly scrubbed later in the operating table. I knew I had only seconds. So instead of trying an overt heart massage, he says that as I cut the rib cage and put my hand into the chest cavity to have a direct heart massage and kept going and going and going at it, but it was just blubber in my hands. I could not revive her. He said, I was quite shattered by the sight I'd seen. He said, in my years of surgery, I'd never seen a body so badly battered by another human being. He said, it was hard to keep my emotions removed from what I was seeing. So I went over to the sink to wash my hands again. And as I was doing that, the nurse came and she said, Doctor, I think you better examine her bag and her possessions very quickly here. And she emptied it out, and she was obviously a drug junkie with used needles and all of that in there, drug paraphernalia. He said, as she was telling me that, I looked at my hand, and in my haste to thrust the hand into her rib cage, I had nicked my finger. And I looked at that cut finger, and he said, I don't know what I've done to myself. I said, is it a deep cut? He said, no, it's actually a paper-thin cut. I said, what are you afraid of? He said, this kind of person using used needles, it could be anything, HIV, whatever. He said, I'm scared as a young father with a young family. I said, when will you know the results of the test? He said, the positive tests can only be done within 2 to 3 days. I just am calling you to pray for me. And I said to him before I hung up, I said, are you telling me a paper-thin cut in contact with that kind of diseased blood leaves you in this kind of jeopardy? He said, doesn't take anything more than that. Think about it. A paper-thin cut in contact with the diseased blood of that fear that he had could actually make you non-resistant to any kind of disease and any kind of threat. Your immunity system could be shattered with a drop of blood. I wonder how many cuts we sometimes incur in our soul of a paper-thin nature, and look back upon the years and say, when did that actually happen? You know, I know a place like here and many other parts of the world deal with issues of pornography and things that are available on the internet to young lives and young minds. And I've wondered whether peddlers and that kind of stuff have ever looked at the end result of the havoc they have created and the paper cuts they have put into the souls of men and women. so that a little guy watching that stuff is so seared that 20 years later, when he's a young married man, he cannot get those images out of his mind and has actually risked the destruction of his entire home and his future at the hands of somebody who put that little laceration into his soul. And so I speak especially to you young men and to those of you in business who travel. Half of my life is spent on the road. Even last night, my colleague and I, in the elevator, somebody propositioning you for some kind of pleasure to come into your room. And you pause and you say to yourself, how does a person resist such seduction on the road if you have no moral boundaries by which to govern your life? If you don't draw the line and you develop hungers and appetites early in your life, it is very hard to shake off the appetite in years to come. Ask anybody who's battled issues like that. Whether it's a bribe under the table, or a pleasure for a moment, or a tryst that took place that you thought would come like a whirlwind and go, and it didn't. The remains stayed for years and years and years to come. Daniel is the kind of hero who tells us why he is heroic. He knows where to draw the lines in the right places. You have to train your hungers. You have to train your appetite. It is the early choices that provide the paper cuts, the contact with other threats. Now, I want to say this to you as well. Maybe for some in an audience like this, you may say, Ravi, I wish I had thought of something like this 20 years ago. For me, a lot of it is too late. The cuts are deep and deep. I don't want you to despair. The grace of God reaches you wherever you are. And if those mistakes were made years and years ago, return to Him for His grace and forgiveness, and turn, don't continue in the tragedy that began so long. Those things can be turned around by the grace and the mercy of God. That is the distinctive of the Christian faith, that He is a forgiving and a gracious God and a healer of our wounds and the corrector of our ways. So don't live under the delusion that it is too late. If the mistakes are made, yes, they are made, but the corrective is there. This is the gospel of Christ, who looked at an audience that was sending Him to His cross, and He says, Father, forgive them. In the most heinous act in history, the Son prayed for the forgiveness of the perpetrators. How much more would He be willing to forgive you and me for the mistakes we've made early in life and the youth of our life, and help us to rebuild? But you must learn to draw the line of resistance in order to train your appetite. But there's a second line. His line of dependence on what it was he was going to lean on. It was not just that he resisted. He knew what he was going to depend on. And the dependence for him was not so much on his learning, but on the wisdom that God had given to him. You know, my hazard, the hazard of my trade, is books. I have to live with books. My back has been injured because of books. I have to carry books everywhere I go. If you even looked at my case of sermon books now, where I carry about 100 to 150 sermons, I'll never check them in. Anybody in the airline industry, no offense, but I have no confidence my books will show up with me if I check them in, so I carry them with me. It's books. When I was doing my work at Cambridge University, any one of you who's been to the main King's Parade in Cambridge, a beautiful street, and right at the first Trinity College, opposite Trinity College, is a massive bookstore called Heffer's. Any one of you who's been there, Heffer's has thousands and thousands of volumes. It was my daily dessert to go into Heffer's. And I'm sorry to even tell this to you from a pulpit, but the older you get, the less embarrassed you get with some things. I remember when I would go into Heffer's, my wife or one of my little kids would be with me. If it was my little kids, I'd just give them a book to read, say, I'll be around here. But the excitement would build within seconds of me stepping into Heifer's. I'd always have to say, excuse me, I have to step into the restroom for a moment and come back. I'm just too excited to see these books. If you go to a place in Wales called Heon Wye, it's the used book capital of the world. You can spend days in there with the scone and coffee and books and books and books. I'm not surprised that when Paul was in prison, he says, bring me my books. What a wonderful treasure we have in books. But there is a book that is the greatest book of all, and your confidence had better not be in just books. It had better be in the wisdom of God that instructs you and teaches you in the way that you should go. That's when you need the wisdom. I remember being with the leader of one of the four leaders of Hamas in Ramallah, Jerusalem. I was with the former Archbishop of Canterbury and three or four others. We were asked to meet with the Israeli leaders and the Palestinian leaders in an effort to bring some kind of conversation going. And the group had met with Yasser Arafat that morning. I pulled out myself out of that meeting. I had my suspicions that we'd be used for publicity rather than for anything else. But I agreed to meet with the Hamas leader who'd spent 18 years in prison. And I asked him a question. I asked him we were all allowed one question each, and he'd given us a huge meal in his home, and his sons and all these burly-chested guys standing around him. And he gives us this massive meal, and we're all given a chance for one question. So I looked at him, and I had asked him a question on suicide bombing. And he gave an answer. I was not quite sure how to react. I wasn't comfortable with it, but I wasn't there to get political. And so I just said this to him, and he said how many children he'd lost in this tragedy. I said, Sheikh, I said, very close to where you and I are sitting is a hill. I said, 5,000 years ago, Abraham went up that mountain, and he brought his son to sacrifice as an expression of faith, and seconds before the axe was to come down, God stopped his hand. Do you remember the story? He said, yes. I said, you all believe it was Ishmael, we believe it was Isaac, we don't need to argue about that now, for that's not the point. I said, it was his son. And as the axe is about to fall on that head, God says, stop. He nodded. I said, do you remember what God said after that? He shook his head. I said, God said, I myself will provide. He said, yeah. I said, 2,000 years ago on a hill very close to where you and I are sitting right now, God kept that promise. He brought his own son. And I said, Sheikh Talal, this time the axe did not stop. He just looked at me. I said, I may never see you again, but I want to say this to you, this. Until you and I receive the son that God has provided for us, we'll be offering our own sons on the battlefields of this world for land and power and ownership, possession. The room was full of smoke. Not a single voice was uttered. And they called the meeting to an end. And as I was walking down the stairs, the Archbishop put his arm around me, and I didn't know if I'd said the right thing or the wrong thing. But he said, Ravi, that was of God. That was of God. And I didn't know what the Sheikh was going to do. Went over to my SUV as I was about to get in, and he came over to me and he pulled me to himself, and he went like this, and he kissed me on both sides of the face. He said, you're a good man. I hope I see you again someday. And turned and walked away. Now, I wish I could always say to you words like that emerged exactly when needed. But every now and then God puts the words into your mouth to remind you He is in control, and He will tell you what to say and what not to say. You had better depend on His wisdom in these moments of huge conflicts much more than any other book could help you. The Word of God can be a lamp unto your feet and a light unto your path. He drew the line of resistance. He drew his line of dependence. And lastly, he drew his line of confidence. What was his line of confidence? His line of confidence was this, that even though God was allowing them to go through this furnace of fire. He said, God will deliver us, but even if God does not deliver us, I will not bend my knee to a false god. He drew the line with Nebuchadnezzar and the leaders. He said, you want me to bend my knee to the false gods you've erected? I'm not going to do it. And as a result of my resistance, you're going to throw me into the flames of fire. You can do it. I believe my God will deliver me. But even if God doesn't deliver me, I will not bend my knee to the false god you're asking me to bend. Here's what Daniel is saying. I have complete confidence in God and His protection. Even if He doesn't protect me in the way I would like to be protected, it is not going to change my allegiance and the bending of my knee to Him. That's what you don't just call faith, but faith that is based on the reason of God's transcending sovereignty. We don't understand everything there is to understand. We think we do. We think we have all the facts and all of the knowledge before us. We don't. But we do know this, there is somebody who does. And that is Almighty God Himself. And through history, He has unfolded His pattern. You may be going through a time in your life right now which you don't understand. You may come to terms with it someday and recognize God was weaving His great design and His great pattern into your life. You know, just recently I had back surgery. This is my first speaking engagement after my back surgery. I'd been off the road for 12 weeks. Very critical back surgery. And it could have gone all the wrong way. During the middle of the back surgery, the lining of my spinal cord tore. And the surgeon said I was in serious threat of losing my eyesight, of losing my stability, waist and below paralysis could have stepped in because of what happened in the midst of that surgery. And you, when you wake up and come to, and he looks at you and he says something like this, he said, you are my prisoner for 4 days. You had dare not move. He said, I've sewn back the lining, but it's like sewing back, he said, like sewing back wet toilet paper. He said, Ravi, if that thing doesn't hold, I can't tell you all that looms ahead for you in your life, and I don't want that to happen to you. And I said, what do you mean, don't move? He said, I mean just that. You are not going to move for 4 days. And so for 4 days, you're lying still in that bed, and you have an awful lot of time to think. What if? What if? What if after 4 days I stand up and find out it hasn't taken? And at times like that you realize life is so fragile. Everything you have confidence in can be shattered. And the doctor's orders were critical for me. He's told you what it takes to be a righteous person. You break that, you do it at great risk and at great cost. You see, when you break the laws of God, you really don't break those laws. You end up breaking yourself on those laws and proving those laws. It's as simple as that. And when I look at a man like this, I say, Lord, please help me to follow an example like this. A man who draws his line of resistance, who draws his line of dependence, and who draws his line of confidence. You know what? 3 pagan monarchs in a row crossed over to his side of the territory because he never crossed over to theirs. He gave an example of how to live. If you want to be a true hero, look at the real heroes. It is not the demagogues whose crestfallen countenance are on the sand, but the one whom God wants to drill and thrill. Let me close with this great Wesley hymn. O thou who camest from above, the pure celestial fire to impart, kindle a flame of sacred love on the mean altar of my heart. There let it for thy glory burn with inextinguishable blaze, and trembling to its source return in humble prayer and fervent praise. Jesus, confirm my heart's desire to work and speak and think for thee. still let me guard the holy fire, and still stir up thy gifts in me. Ready for all thy perfect will, my acts of faith and love repeat, till death thy endless mercy seal, and make my sacrifice complete, to work and speak and think for thee. Write that down somewhere, and make it the goal of your life, to work and speak and think for thee. You know, that is the pattern of true success and true righteousness. May God be with you, and thank you so much for giving me the honor of ministering to you today.